This is the draft on which Lucas admits he had the most fun. I found it much easier than I expected, he said. Almost enjoyable. In typical Lucas fashion, the dialogue of the sequel's second draft, his first, was wonderfully stilted. At the end of the draft, after Lando and Chewie leave in the Falcon, Luke tells Leia, I will be leaving also. I have left unfinished things. Leia responds, You know it's Han I love, don't you? Luke, Yes. But I have been swept into another sphere. Han is better for you. Gone with the wind, this ain't. Still, much of what we know as The Empire Strikes Back settled into place in the second draft, with only minor differences in structure. The Imperial invasion of Hoth now featured huge walking machines, which had already been sketched out by designer Joe Johnston. This is as good a point as any to address a falsehood that has persisted for years in the Bay Area. Namely that the AT-ATs, as those Imperial walkers became known, were inspired by the giant four-legged cranes at the Port of Oakland. Lucas denies this. The truth is wilder. Joe Johnston was inspired by a four-legged tank, a concept vehicle designed by General Electric in 1968 called the Cybernetic Anthropomorphous Machine. The CAM had been commissioned by the Army for possible use in Vietnam. GE only abandoned it when the design turned out to be too exhausting to operate. Intentionally or otherwise, Lucas and Johnston were continuing the analogy between the Empire's fight against the Rebellion and America's fight in Vietnam. Han hides the Falcon in an asteroid field, a scene ripped from the first draft of The Star Wars. Luke leaves Yoda and Ben precipitously on Dagobah, leading Yoda to declare that they must find another. When he appears in Cloud City to welcome our heroes, Lando is no longer a clone. When Vader captures Han and Leia, he tortures both of them. Han is frozen in carbonite and handed over to bounty hunter Boba Fett, a plot point that deals with the recalcitrant Ford, who is consistently asking that Han be killed off. And then, in the first handwritten version of his post-bracket draft, Lucas arrived at his twist in the tale. During the climactic lightsaber battle with Darth Vader, the Sith Lord is trying to get the young Skywalker to come over to the dark side. He encourages Luke's hatred. I destroyed your family. I destroyed Kenobi. Then he makes an incongruous offer. We will rule the galaxy as father and son. What? Says Luke. And we're right there with him. Wait. Back up. Why would Vader give the game away in what amounts to a Freudian slip? The dramatic reveal comes a few lines later. I am your father. Search your feelings, he insists. You know it to be true. Lucas would later claim that he had Vader in mind as Luke's father all along, but he has also copped to a whole lot of spontaneity in his writing. When you're creating something like that, the characters take over, he said in 1993, and they begin to tell the story apart from what you're doing. Then you have to figure out how to put the puzzle back together so it makes sense. Here's how it may have played out. The moment when the maybe of Luke's parentage collapsed into a certainty. Lucas wrote the lightsaber battle on vacation in Mexico, working feverishly fast, caught by the muse. He understood the audience would know Luke isn't going to die. They needed a reason to fear for him in this moment. The jeopardy, as Lucas had noted in his story conference with Brackett, is that Luke might get turned to the dark side of the Force. So he peppered Vader's dialogue with reasons for Luke to give in to his hatred. What reasons might they be? Well, we know from the first movie Vader killed Luke's father, so let's have him say something like that. Maybe make it even bigger. I destroyed your family. Your family. Your father. Anakin Skywalker. The loose thread that refuses to be tied up. Darth Vader, the mystery man inside the iron lung suit. We know so little about them. The movie thus far had stubbornly refused to advance either character. It was especially irritating, given that the Joseph Campbell formula calls for some intense father action at this point in the story. In The Hero with a Thousand Faces, Campbell explains that the hero reconciling with the father is an essential, almost religious component of all myth. The problem of the hero going to meet the father is to open his soul beyond terror to such a degree that he will be ripe to understand how the sickening and insane tragedies of this vast and ruthless cosmos are completely validated in the majesty of being. But wait a second. We will rule the galaxy as father and son, the character makes him write. Finally, definitively, whether he'd thought of it before or not, new worlds opened up for Lucas to conquer. Vader was already supposed to be a Jedi Knight who turned to the dark side and betrayed the Jedi. But if Vader were simply a new name for Skywalker, well, that would bring the betrayal up to decidedly operatic levels. It would explain at a stroke why everyone from Uncle Owen to Obi-Wan to Yoda has been so concerned about Luke's development and whether he would grow up to be like his father. The unification of Anakin Skywalker and Darth Vader removed a lot of redundancy from the storyline. You can see the problem plain as day in Brackett's first draft, where Yoda summons Obi-Wan, who in turn summons Skywalker Pear. Suddenly Dagobah is full of old, noble Jedi ghosts who are basically the same character, says author Michael Kaminsky. For the rest of the production, Vader's secret was kept under wraps as much as possible. Lucas was careful even about telling Kirshner. He really wanted the twist to reach as many audiences as possible in an unspoiled state. Only one thing would ultimately give the game away, and with Lucasfilm's blessing, the novelization of The Empire Strikes Back, written by Lucas's USC pal Don Glut, which would come out 1 week in advance of the movie and sell 3 million copies. Once again, the plot of the entire movie would be hidden in plain sight, perfectly accessible to the literate and interested. Once again, Star Wars would prove to be more than just a movie franchise. Glut had turned down the novelization of Star Wars, but still had his finger in the Star Wars pie, as he puts it. He had originally been contracted to write a Wookiee-based novel. After the disaster of the holiday special, Glut got a call from Carol Titelman, Charlie Lippincott's former girlfriend, who was now in charge of Lucasfilm's nascent publishing division, as well as the upcoming National Public Radio adaptation of Star Wars. Titelman took Glut out to lunch and said, "Forget the Wookiee novel. We want you to write The Empire Strikes Back." This time, he would be allowed to put his own name on the cover. Glut was offered a relatively small advance on royalties, rather than the flat fee Foster was granted for the Star Wars novelization. It wasn't the best deal in the history of publishing, but Glut was told, "If you turn it down, there are people who will pay us to write it." Glut found Lucasfilm a hive of self-imposed secrecy. "They were so paranoid," he says. "Some people could look at the scripts but not see the artwork. Some people could see the artwork but not the scripts. They literally locked me inside a trailer with all the Macquarie paintings." He made sketches in a notebook and remembered showing an employee one sketch when he came out. "Is this Yoda?" Glut asked. The employee threw his hands over his eyes. "Don't tell me! I don't want to know!" While the talent at Lucasfilm raced to prepare for the making of a second film, Lucas seemed less interested in the movie than he did in the utopian future film community of Bulltail Ranch, soon to be renamed Skywalker. Here, finally, was the Marin County dream Lucas had nurtured since John Cordy had first invited him up there in 1968. It was hidden away on Lucas Valley Road, the name of which was a happy coincidence. John Lucas was a 19th-century Marinite who inherited the land from his uncle. The 1,700-acre valley was wild and grassy, green in the spring and yellow in the summer and fall. It was utterly enclosed, a world unto itself, with deer bounding through the valley and mountain lions patrolling the tree-lined hills. Skywalker Ranch was to remain as secret as the script throughout the making of Empire. Initially, the land deed was in the name of Lucas's accountant, which was just as well, since the combination on the padlock fence at the ranch entrance was ridiculously easy to guess. 1138. Just as he gave his scripts to trusted friends, Lucas brought Hal Barwood and others to the ranch in June 1978. He explained the dream. It would remain, for the most part, a ranch. They would plant walnut trees, just like the ones on the ranch home he spent his teenage years in. They would build a vineyard and raise cattle, maybe horses. The buildings would be few and far between, so sparsely arranged that you wouldn't be able to see one building from another. That plan was partly due to the fact that Marin had not zoned the land for development, but it also reflected Lucas's vision of an agrarian utopia for filmmakers and writers. Creative types, Lucas believed, couldn't work traditional 8-hour days. They weren't at their best in cities. They needed to refresh the well with long midday breaks, games of frisbee, or walks in the hills, perhaps with the extra adrenaline boost of running into a mountain lion. For the time being, Skywalker Ranch was just a vision that Lucas kept sketching out on his notepads. The land was a place for picnics, an off-roader's paradise where Gary Kurtz enjoyed driving around at top speed. But the fact that the ranch was just an idea didn't diminish its power, not when it came from the guy who had been doodling space troopers in those notepads not so long ago. Lucas brought Kirshner to his office to show him his plans for the ranch and impressed on him that only Kirshner could make them real. All he had to do was direct the most successful sequel of all time. No pressure. Throughout 1978, Lucas lured a half-dozen ILM staffers out of Van Nuys, north to Marin, but he had to put them in another industrial building in nearby San Rafael. To shield it from curious fans, there was no ILM branding. Instead, the building bore the logo of a fictional entity, the Kerner Company Optical Research Lab. Some 27 new ILMers were hired by the new year. This was the state of a filmmaker at the height of his powers. Life at top speed with an empire to build, a focus on big picture ideas, and an increasingly large cast of people who were worrying about the details, eager to please. Something Coppola once told him was starting to come true. Fame and fortune were a kind of death, in the sense that you were reborn as a new person. Casual fans could be forgiven for thinking Lucas had little to do with Empire Strikes Back. His name was only the fourth on screen in its closing credits, based on a story by Lee Brackett and Lawrence Kasdan are credited as the screenwriters, with no suggestion of the crucial second or third drafts Lucas wrote in between their work. Still, of the two screenwriters who are credited instead of Lucas, Lawrence Kasdan had by far the greater impact. Kasdan had been brought into Lucas's discussions with Spielberg about Raiders because Spielberg loved an earlier script of Kasdan's, Continental Divide. As soon as Kasdan turned in his Raiders script, Lucas tapped him to do his third ever script, a draft of Empire, without so much as reading his work on Raiders. Post-Brackett, it was a vulnerable moment. I was desperate, Lucas later admitted. Kasdan was to be to Empire what Hike and Katz were to Star Wars, only instead of heavily rewriting 30% of the dialogue, he would lightly rewrite pretty much all of it. Yoda owed his backwards grammar to Lucas, who thought this was how a guru might sound. But he owes the brevity and memorability of his lines to Kasdan. You can also credit Kasdan with lengthening Leia and Han's romantic scenes and introducing the word scoundrel into their dialogue. The back of Vader's head is seen in his private cubicle by an underling as a machine slips on the Dark Lord's helmet. This tantalizing glimpse was also a Kasdan invention. Kasdan and Kirshner challenged everything in the script, Lucas said later, and that was what he wanted. If they had a great idea or they had a point, it immediately went in. Lucas wanted the script to move fast. Kasdan wanted emotional depth. It turned into a gentle tug of war, Lennon and McCartney, if one of the Beatles had been 1,000 times richer than the other. But the script writing was just one of many elements that made Empire so memorable. Yoda's body, rather than his dialogue, was the major fear of the pre-production phase. If the puppet didn't work, Lucas knew, the whole illusion of the movie would be sunk. Joe Johnston came up with the look of the wizened alien guru, but turning it into reality was harder than expected, and trying to pull it off with a Henson-style Muppet was no sure thing. At first, the 2001 veteran Stuart Freeborn experimented with dressing up a baby monkey in a Yoda suit. Only when that clearly did not work did Kurtz make a pilgrimage to Jim Henson's house, taking Edward Summer along for the ride and swearing him to secrecy. Henson paused long enough to make a pun. The mass-market version of this thing, he quipped, should be called a Toyota, before passing on the project. He was far too busy with the Muppet movie. Days later, however, he showed the Yoda sketch to his collaborator, Frank Oz, who wasn't too busy. What Oz did with Freeborn's designs and Kasdan's words not only made Henson proud, but created a guru for the ages. In 1980, Yoda was to spark serious debate over whether a puppet could be nominated for an acting Oscar. By 2013, he was to receive the most votes from StarWars.com visitors in Lucasfilm's first official online character tournament, beating the might of Darth Vader himself in the final round. With Oz at the helm of the puppet, locating his voice somewhere between Miss Piggy and Fozzie Bear, Yoda started to take shape. But it would take all of Lucasfilm's ingenuity and all of Kirshner's patience to create and film multiple realistic puppet versions of the creature, offering the illusion that he could move independently of Oz. Kirshner would curse the little green guy's name for the rest of the picture. Meanwhile, what his boss was going through and insulating Kirshner from was 10 times worse than the proper positioning of a recalcitrant puppet. Financing Empire was a serious and constant headache for Lucas. The budget had inflated to $18 million. Payroll alone in 1979 was more than $1 million a week, with another $2 million a week being spent on the shoot after March 1979. The movie was behind schedule almost immediately. In an echo of the problems on Star Wars, there was a natural disaster on the first week of location shooting in the northernmost climes of Finse, Norway. This time it was a freak avalanche rather than a freak desert storm. Instead of cutting days and scenes out of the shoot as Lucas had been forced to, Kirshner and Kurtz let it fall behind schedule. Kurtz announced to Lucas that the budget was now $22 million. Toy sales came to the rescue. Despite the movie no longer being in theaters, despite the disastrous holiday special and against all expectations, Kenner announced that it had its strongest holiday season yet. Sales of Star Wars action figures, spaceships, and playsets had crossed the $200 million mark, funneling more than $20 million into Lucasfilm subsidiary Black Falcon. Without that cash injection, there's little question Empire would have been sunk. There's something poetic about it. Millions of children joyfully acting out the further adventures of Luke Skywalker literally funded the further adventures of Luke Skywalker. Call it a karmic Kickstarter. Even with the Black Falcon revenues, Lucas found himself constantly having to put out fires. In July 1979, the Bank of America loan was automatically halted when Lucasfilm's payroll hit $1 million. This was red tape at its reddest, the rigid policy of a new loan manager who looked only at the numbers and was unfamiliar with his client. Lucasfilm was days away from defaulting on paychecks. Oddly enough, some of the blame lay with Coppola. B of A had a nightmarish experience funding Apocalypse Now. Coppola asked for an extra $16 million over his initial budget. The bank still wasn't sure it would get the money back. Once bitten, twice shy, B of A cut Lucas off. Ironically, Lucas had been devoting a few spare days here and there to helping Coppola edit the mounds of film he had brought back with him from the Philippines. Lucas was trying to make sure that the movie he washed his hands of back in 1975 made Coppola proud and made B of A's money back. He was doing a good deed for his friend, and it was not going unpunished by his friend's bank. Lucas had to turn to his real estate business CEO to end the financial crisis. Weber worked the phones, and Bank of America handed over the loan to the First National Bank of Boston. Lucas had some breathing room. The budget could now extend to $27.7 million, but the shoot kept getting further and further behind schedule. By late July, when the Dagobah set was under construction, Kirsch was lagging by more than a month. To compound the problem, Kurtz had currency trouble, the exact opposite situation from what they had during Star Wars. The pound was rising against the dollar. The markets had given a vote of confidence to Margaret Thatcher, who was elected prime minister as Kirsch was filming in her country. Suddenly, Lucas's set bills ballooned by $3 million, bringing the total to $31 million. Francis Coppola, Bank of America, and Margaret Thatcher nearly torpedoed The Empire Strikes Back. Sounds crazy, but it's true. Lucas vowed to the Boston bank that he would pay the loan off for the rest of his life if the movie didn't break even. It wasn't enough. First, Boston required Fox to act as a guarantor. That was the last thing in the world Lucas wanted, but it was either that, or he would be forced to shut down the shoot. Fox agreed, in exchange for a better cut of the distribution money. They didn't have to put any cash down to get it. When Lando Calrissian talked about his deal with the Empire getting worse all the time, it would have been hard for Lucas not to think of his own situation with Fox. The more Star Wars money Fox had, the less went to the ranch. This dream was getting worse all the time. Lucas decamped to London several times during 1979. He had hoped to stay away. He was trying to tell Kurtz that it was his job to stop Kirsch overrunning the schedule at a cost of $100,000 of Lucas's money each day. Kurtz would say that he'd done what he could, even directing a second unit himself to film the scenes with Luke in the Wampa's ice cave to try and reduce the overrun. "I tried to rein Kirsch in a bit," Kurtz pleads. "He was very good with the actors, and he was a bit slow." The visual effects team took to rolling their eyes at the director when, for example, filming the scene where the bounty hunter Boba Fett shoots at Luke Skywalker in the corridors of Cloud City. They'd ask Kirsch a simple question. "Where do you want the squibs, the little explosive devices that simulated Fett's laser blasts hitting the wall behind Luke?" Kirsch would point to an area, frowning, uncertain. "Are you sure now?" the team would ask. They would drill holes, put the squibs in, cover them up, do a rehearsal, and then Kirsch would change his mind about the location of the squibs. But ultimately, Kirsch was hard to speed up because Kurtz was enamored with every scene the older director was coming up with. The lighting, the framing, everything. "Kirsch did an outstanding job on Empire," Kurtz says. "The difference between Star Wars and Empire is striking. It's not only better written, but its performances are much less comic booky, darker, and more realistic." And ultimately, Lucas can't blame Kurtz, because Lucas was enamored with Kirsch's transcendent cinematic output at the time as well. We know this, and a lot more besides, thanks to the diary of Alan Arnold, Star Wars' most refined chronicler. Arnold was an English publicist and journalist of the old school, whose resume read like he'd stepped out of a Graham Greene novel. He was a former press officer for Her Majesty's government who served in Cairo and Washington, D.C., and a former foreign correspondent who had visited 30 countries. He had worked with Marilyn Monroe and Marlena Dietrich. He counted Eleanor Roosevelt and Edward Murrow as acquaintances. His books included How to Visit America. Now he was serving Lucas as the unit publicist for Empire Strikes Back at Elstree, and, as part of his role, he got to visit crew in Marin and L.A. Arnold was the Lippincott of Empire Strikes Back. He made hours of interview tapes with all the principals. Unlike Lippincott, he published his work in a stream of consciousness diary format, the now sadly out of print Once Upon a Galaxy. Kirshner was Arnold's most frequent interviewee, but he also captured wonderful sketches of Fisher, Ford, Hamill, and newcomer Billy Dee Williams, who had been picked to play Lando because Lucas loved him in the Billie Holiday biopic Lady Sings the Blues. But it was Lucas who proved to be Arnold's most intriguing interviewee. The creator was now floating the notion that he had written six discrete treatments in the form of two trilogies before finishing Star Wars, and that after the success of Star Wars, I added another trilogy, for a grand total of 9 movies, or, as he claimed in another interview around this time, 12. Lucas walked the 12-movie claim back in an interview with Preview Magazine in 1980, in which he said movies 10 to 12 were potential spin-offs he had abandoned. Movies on droids. Movies on Wookiees, rather than episodes in the saga. How much Lucas actually wrote, we don't know. But in 2005, he said he never wrote anything at all for episode 7 onwards. He was already changing his tune as early as 1987. "I'll guarantee that the first three are pretty much organized in my head, But the other three are kind of out there somewhere, Lucas said. There's a pattern here. The pattern of an artist enamored with positive thinking, trying to will his work into being by talking about it as if it existed. Lucas told Steven Spielberg he had written two more treatments for Indiana Jones movies after Raiders of the Lost Ark. It turned out George did not have the stories in mind, Spielberg recalled later. We had to make up all the subsequent stories. To Arnold, Lucas appeared to be quite zen about the possibility of losing all his money before he had a chance to finish the second of those 12 movies. I'm willing to take that risk because I started with nothing, he said. 5 years ago, I had nothing. If this is just one of those mildly successful sequels, I'll lose everything. I could end up being millions in debt. It would probably take me the rest of my life to get out from under. But the risk was worth it for the ranch. Mostly, it will be a place to think, he mused, and to make films without regard for commerciality. As much as Lucas loved Star Wars, it was now a means to an end, the creation of a filmmaking paradise. How soon Lucas's dreams had outstripped his money in the bank. The money needed is so enormous that the money I have doesn't amount to anything, he told Arnold. The only way to do it is to create a company that will generate profits. That would mean turning Star Wars into a self-sustaining entity, a franchise that Lucas wouldn't have to get completely involved in. Sending the universe, in other words, out of the nest on its own. But in order to relinquish complete control over the growing Star Wars franchise, Lucas would have to ensure that the audience knew the quality wasn't going to drop as it had during the holiday special. And that meant making Empire Strikes Back the best movie it could possibly be. He understood that Kirsch was doing that, and Lucas was clearly conflicted about it and about whether he'd do a better job. He said he hired Kirsch because his reputation is one of being a fast director, and a very good one. Could he speed up the process? Probably, said the boy from the land of Zoom. Kurtz's assessment was different. Lucas had been laid so low by Star Wars that the pressures of directing this film would have laid him out completely, the producer told Arnold. The real trouble with Lucas's plan to let go of Star Wars was that the idea of it wasn't ready to abandon its host. The truth of it is, I got captivated, he says. It's in me now. I can't help but get upset or excited when something isn't the way it's supposed to be. I can see that world. I know the way the characters live and breathe. In a way, they have taken over. Kirsch, for his part, had his own ideas about why the shy Lucas might have had a hard time confronting his elder mentor director over the speed of his work. I've caught him looking through a camera only twice so far, and he looked at me as guiltily as if he'd stolen a cookie. All Lucas would tell him about the rushes he was receiving was, I love them. Behind the scenes, according to Kurtz, Kirsch's blunt response whenever he was confronted with how long he was taking was simply, you guys hired me to do this job. Let me do this job. Kirsch was most at home with his young leads, taking his time to mentor them. In particular, Kirsch recognized Harrison Ford was mature and strong enough to shape his own role. Arnold captured many moments where Ford riffed on his dialogue, with Kirsch acting as a wise old sounding board. When Han and Leia land in Cloud City, and Lando plants a flirtatious kiss on Leia's hand, Ford's line as written was, she's traveling with me, Lando, and I don't intend to gamble her away, so you might as well forget she exists. But that seemed a burst of jealousy too far, not to mention a little paternalistic. Ford came up with a line that had plenty more interpretation to it. You old smoothie. Arnold also captured a crucial moment in Ford's trailer, where the star and the director were discussing Han's final moments in Cloud City before he gets frozen in carbonite. Ford, I think I should be manacled. It won't stop the love scene. I don't have to put my arms around Leia to kiss her. As I pass her by, I think Leia ought to say very simply, I love you. Kirshner, and you say, just remember that, Leia, because I'll be back. You've got to say, I'll be back. You must. It's almost contractual. Ford, if she says, I love you, and I say, I know, that's beautiful and acceptable and funny. Kirshner, right, right. You know what? I may keep Vader out of this till the end. In case you missed that, because Kirsch seems to have done, Harrison Ford came up with one of the most memorable lines of the film, of the entire series, in his trailer, over coffee and fruit. A Lucasfilm documentary, Empire of Dreams, would later suggest that Ford only spoke that line as the last of a dozen or more takes. That may have been true, but it left out the essential fact that it was premeditated by Ford and pre-approved by Kirsch. The script supervisor's final notes from the set had the "I know" line in there. Lucas screened two different versions of the movie for a test audience, one with the line in and one without it. Audiences laughed at the line. Lucas didn't understand why. Kirsch and Ford had to explain. Laughter was the only way you get an emotional release in what is clearly a very powerful and difficult scene. If Kirsch was content to let the actors rework their dialogue, he was not so easygoing about everything on set. This director was even more of a perfectionist about lighting than Lucas. He came up with the movie's most memorable visual palette on the carbonite freezing set. "We didn't want the comic strip look, but a look of diffused color," he said, describing an aesthetic that contrasted markedly with the first movie. "People's faces have green on one side and red on the other, or the scene is orange and blue." When the cast was taken of the Han Solo frozen in carbonite prop, it was Kirshner who suggested the iconic arresting pose. Han would have thrown his hands up to protect himself against the process. Ford complimented Kirshner's creative style perfectly. Fisher was, well, a different kettle of fish. Kirshner had a much harder time dealing with the actress and her frequent illnesses. Some really were illnesses, and she did go to hospital for a stomach checkup. But more than a few of the incidents could be explained by the combination of her Party Central flat in St. John's Wood, her friendship with the Rolling Stones, her newfound coke habit, and, at least on one occasion, a bottle of harsh Tunisian liquor brought over by Eric Idle of Monty Python. As he compiled his record of the filmmaking process, Arnold dismissed a bout of crew gossip that she'd been up all night, when in fact she had, and delicately drew a veil over Fisher's private life. "She was allergic to a lot of things, and doesn't always look after herself as she should," he wrote. It was harder to draw a veil over Fisher's on-set freakouts. She was frustrated with Ford's freedom to change his dialogue on a whim, and paranoid that much of the script was being changed behind her back. She yelled at Ford. She told Kirsch at one point, and "it kind of screwed me up." Kirsch encouraged Fisher to yell at him instead. They discussed whether Leia should slap Lando. Billy Dee Williams was concerned because Lando gets slapped around a lot, but he was game to try it. Fisher lashed out so hard. Williams, "Don't hit me like that." Fisher, "Did it hurt?" Williams, "Of course it hurt." Fisher, "I'm sorry. How do you hit someone?" Williams, "If you want to hit me, fake it." Fisher, alone among the lead actors, was utterly frustrated with her character. "I know Leia's favorite color is white," she said, "but that was about it. She is more of a caricature, somewhat one-dimensional." Luke had to grapple with the lure of the dark side after a disturbing revelation. Han got his sacrificial freezing scene. Lando got to redeem his betrayal and bad deal with the Empire. Leia? She was still handy with a blaster, sure, but all she got to learn was how to tremble in Han's arms, how to use a good kiss, how to tell a man you love him. It wasn't that playing opposite Ford in the romantic scenes didn't have its virtues. Special effects gave him a very good mouth, she said. It was that Fisher was starting to discover the curse of Star Wars. Her career had stalled outside of this caricature. "I function exclusively in space, it seems," she said. Fisher was the first Star Wars actor to make this disturbing discovery, but she certainly would not be the last. Meanwhile at ILM, Lucas was more willing to urge his underlings to do their best work as fast as possible. Phil Tippett had gone from animating the stop-motion chess set in the final days of Star Wars in that grimy warehouse in Van Nuys to heading up an entire stop-motion department in San Rafael. Or rather, go-motion, a technique that Tippett helped pioneer on Empire. It involved connecting models of Tauntauns and AT-ATs to tiny motors that moved them every time the camera shot its frame. So when you strung the frames together, the object's movement appears far more natural than in regular stop motion. That's why AT-ATs don't move anything like classic Ray Harryhausen skeletons. Tippett remembers the moment he realized he had become more of a perfectionist than Lucas. When he wasn't happy with the movements of his tauntauns, "I'd have to argue to do another take," Tippett says. He'd say, "It's fine." Then he'd say, "Okay, one more take." Tippett knew that his 33-year-old millionaire boss was caught between the demands of art and the demands of his bank, and it was clearly agonizing. "Still, he never micromanaged us," Tippett says. "He was very inclusive and respectful. We'd ask him, 'Does the Tauntaun do this or that?' And he'd say, 'That's what you guys do. Do what you want.' When you manage creative people that way, you get so much more work out of them." Lucas's frustration would only spill out once when the shoot was over and Kurtz and Kirsch were back in San Anselmo. Lucas decided to re-edit the movie himself, insistent that Kirsch had paced it too slowly, and this time, by all accounts, the result sucked. Super editor was way too stressed out to do good work. Editor Paul Hirsch talked him down. "You guys are ruining my picture," Lucas fumed, but he relented. Once the final footage was assembled the way Kirsch intended, it was clear that what resulted from all this group effort was a hybrid. On the one hand, the sequel was very much like the first Star Wars. Lucas had opted to make it clear that Star Wars was the name of a franchise, not a movie. He would open with the same "A Long Time Ago" intro, the same Susie Rice logo, the same fanfare. Only the crawl would reveal that we were in a different episode. The episode 5 thing confused a lot of audience members who wondered, not unnaturally, whether they had somehow missed episodes 2 through 4. The initial plan was to have the crawl fade in over the landscape of Hoth and open on the Tauntauns. You can still see it that way in the comic book version. But at the last minute, Lucas decided that every Star Wars movie would open in space, with Star Destroyers. In this case, one launching probe droids. On the other hand, the new film was a darker beast than its predecessor, a fairy tale of the grimmer, grim variety. The hellish sequence toward the end of the movie, in which Han is frozen in carbonite, and Luke loses a lightsaber duel with Vader, loses his hand, learns about his father, and then tumbles down a wind shaft toward the gas planet, all within the space of 20 minutes, is one of the most terrifying and traumatizing moments in children's cinema. Waiting until the very last minute to tell Mark Hamill the line James Earl Jones was going to say certainly helped Hamill sell that crucial scene. Vader's revelation was every bit as controversial as Lucas had hoped. Not everyone instantly believed that he was telling the truth. Even Luke muttering, "Ben, why didn't you tell me?" as he hangs from a satellite below Cloud City, near death, wasn't necessarily enough to convince. This line had been added in the very last draft. If Vader was telling the truth, the saintly Obi-Wan had lied about Luke's father. James Earl Jones himself, reading Vader's line, "I am your father," had this reaction the moment he said it. He's lying. Lucas says he talked to child psychologists who claimed that kids under a certain age, around 8 or 9, would simply disbelieve Vader. I count myself, age 7, among the disbelievers. One thing is certain. Debate about the veracity of Vader's claim raged in offices as much as on playgrounds around the world for the next 3 years. As a child, Lucas had been drawn to serial cliffhangers and to the delicious anticipation of what happens next to our heroes. Now Lucas's second draft switch had created the most hotly debated cliffhanger in history, far outlasting the contemporary question of who shot JR on Dallas. Something often forgotten today is that many members of the audience were less than okay with such open-ended endings. This kind of downer was a first for a family-friendly movie, and it was a major achievement for Lucas to be able to sell it. Not all the fans bought it, however. It ends on a very bleak note that may leave certain younger members of the audience downright resentful, reported Starburst, the venerable UK-based monthly science fiction magazine, upon seeing the media preview of the movie. Now, the cliffhanging ending would be fine if we knew we were going to be able to see part 6 next week, next month, or even 6 months from now. But I think expecting us to wait anything between 18 months and 3 years before we find out what happens next is a bit much on the part of Lucas and Company. For one thing, the cinema audience isn't a static entity. It keeps changing from year to year. Yet Lucas and Kurtz are behaving as if it's just one big Star Wars fan club that will patiently wait as the whole story is slowly unwound over a period of 10 to 15 years. The cinema audience was indeed not a static entity. I was one of the ones who joined it for the first time for The Empire Strikes Back. What the Starburst writer could not see without retrospect is that my generation, my 8 to 13 age bracket, had just been handed the greatest gifts by this open-ended fairy tale. Wonderment, the search for answers, and a desire to continue the saga ourselves. I made myself a little cardboard Empire Strikes Back logo. I hadn't quite gotten the message about Lucas's reuse of the Susie Rice logo, so that I could open each episode of Action Figure Playtime by pulling it away through my field of vision. I had Lando and Chewie and Luke and Leia perpetually save the Han in carbonite figure in 100 different ways. No, my generation didn't want to wait between 18 months and 3 years for the next episode, but Star Wars was kept top of mind while we did. We would gladly have waited that long between future movies, if only this saga would last as long as the 10 to 15 years suggested by Starburst. Star Wars was still a fragile thing. Potential licenses certainly didn't see Star Wars lasting that long. While Kenner was eager to replicate its success with action figures and playsets, few other companies had been interested in products related to Empire Strikes Back. Sid Gannis, who'd taken over from Lippincott, recalled going to a shoe department in a store in Cincinnati near Kenner where he failed to make a sale. "I would take out my portable slide projector, find a place to project it onto a wall, do my Empire presentation, and go home." Back then, nobody knew anything about a franchise as wildly lucrative as Star Wars was to become. "Trying to license Empire was like running into a brick wall," said Maggie Young, then the head of licensing. "People looked at the first film as a fluke." The doubters, of course, couldn't have been more wrong. The Empire Strikes Back succeeded beyond any other sequel in history, making $500 million at the box office. Perhaps because we are overly familiar with the original Star Wars, the lingua franca of modern culture, Empire regularly beats its predecessor in polls of the top movies in history. In Empire magazine's rankings thereof, as voted on by prominent directors in 2013, Empire Strikes Back is number 3, while the original movie is number 22. The following year, Empire's readers voted Empire the greatest movie of all time, greater even than The Godfather. At the time, reviews tended toward the Starburst view of things. It seemed breathtakingly arrogant for a filmmaker to make their audience wait until a third movie for any kind of resolution. Still, once they'd seen it, there was a pervasive sense of certainty among viewers that some enormous entertainment franchise the size of the Galactic Empire had just been born. What matters at the moment is that there is no sense that this ebullient, youthful saga is running thin in imagination, or that it has begun to depend excessively on its marvelous special effects. That it is in any danger, in short, of stiffening into mannerism or mere billion-dollar style, wrote Roger Angle in The New Yorker. Vincent Canby's review in The New York Times was the most famous negative one, written long before anyone knew the movie was a hit, and it ends this way, emphasis mine. "The Empire Strikes Back is about as personal as a Christmas card from a bank. I assume that Lucas supervised the entire production and made the major decisions, or at least approved of them. It looks like a movie that was directed at a distance. But at this point, the adventures of Luke, Leia, and Han Solo appear to be a self-sustaining organism, beyond criticism except on a corporate level." The Star Wars phenomenon, as we know it today, was born at the moment it became clear that the second movie, for all its arrogance, was anything but a turkey. From this humble beginning, the second film would grow in reputation until the cinematic son overtook the cinematic father. Looking back on the movie, critics have called it important, weighty, life-altering for any kid of the time. Its denial of good feelings made young viewers grow up fast. The Empire Strikes Back is the only blockbuster of the modern era to celebrate the abysmal failure of its protagonists, wrote cultural critic Chuck Klosterman. It set the philosophical template for all the slackers who would come of age 10 years later. We yearn to be Han Solo, but we end up in Skywalker-ish situations, confronted by the man who turns out to have been our dad all along. Why, we wonder, didn't Ben Kenobi tell us the truth? With the premiere of Empire, certain Lucas characteristics began to assert themselves. The perfectionist obsession with movie technology and the restless tweaking of his creations. He stubbornly insisted on opening the movie only in higher tech and harder to pirate, 70mm, which was much more expensive and kept the number of theaters Empire opened in to 100, little more than 3 times the number of theaters Star Wars opened in. This created another supply and demand problem, with long lines that looked great for the TV cameras, and this time, the cameras were ready on day one. The 35mm print arrived 3 weeks later, eventually reaching 1,400 theaters, far more than Star Wars ever played in simultaneously. In that 3 week gap, Lucas decided to shoot an additional 3 special effects shots to make the ending clearer, causing a stir at ILM. If you guys did this so fast, said Lucas when they were done, only half joking, why did it take so long to do all the other ones? As Lucas was busy cranking his effects making Empire back into high gear for those 3 shots, Darth Vader actor Dave Prose wrote an angry entry in his diary. He had seen the twist ending at a press screening. He had heard the changed dialogue, and he had to record something that greatly concerned him. They have done it again, Prose said. Would you believe it that Fox and Lucasfilm have just issued the press packs for The Empire Strikes Back without one jot of information about myself? 16. Being Boba. When an actor takes on the role of a major character in the Star Wars saga, they're signing up for a lifelong relationship with that character, whether they know it or not. Some thespians, like David Prose, feel more ownership over their characters than Lucasfilm might like. Others, like Mark Hamill, who went on to a prolific career as a voice actor for animated TV shows, have kept their alter egos at a healthy distance. Some, like Anthony Daniels and Peter Mayhew, completely embrace their inner droid and Wookiee, respectively. It's not ownership, it's kinship, says Anthony Daniels. I actually like C-3PO enough to want to look after him, and that is where insanity starts to come in. A handful of other actors, Harrison Ford, prime among them really, really don't like to talk about their characters. Some, like Carrie Fisher, go public with their profound ambivalence. In 2013, Fisher wrote a characteristically hilarious and cutting letter to Leia Organa, whom she was about to play again. Here we are enacting our very own Dorian Gray configuration. You, smooth, certain, and straight-backed, forever condemned to the vast, enviable prison of intergalactic adventure. Me, struggling more and more with post-galactic stress disorder, bearing your scars, graying your eternally dark, ridiculous hair. The main actors who signed onto the franchise in time for The Empire Strikes Back seem to be no exception to this rule. Billy Dee Williams has a complicated relationship with Lando Calrissian, the role he played twice on screen. On the one hand, the 76-year-old actor laments that his other movie roles were overshadowed by the suave gambler and administrator of Cloud City. On the other hand, he is strongly proprietorial of the character. When I interviewed Williams, he reminded me that he has reprised his role in every medium going. The NPR adaptation of Empire Strikes Back, The two Star Wars Battlefront games, Robot Chicken, the Lego Movie sketches on the Cartoon Network, a FunnyOrDie.com video. If Lando were to show up in Episode 7, Williams is ready, though he hadn't gotten a call from Lucasfilm. Still, says Williams, banging his cane, no one's going to play Lando but me. And then there's Jeremy Bullock, a quiet, friendly, yet reserved English gentleman, quite like me, if I might say. He's also ruggedly handsome, athletic, tall, a former footballer, quite unlike me. Bullock, whose character also debuted in Empire, has had the honor of embodying one of the most cultishly popular personalities in the entire Star Wars universe, and managed to do so without letting it go to his head. When I met Bullock, he was dressed in a dapper pinstripe jacket that gave him, along with his well-parted white hair, bony features, and upper-class accent, the air of landed gentry. All he was lacking was a pair of slippers, a pipe, and a regal-looking English dog. A more yawning gulf between actor and character couldn't be imagined. "It's a character that sticks with you," said Bullock, almost apologetically. "I was saying to my grandson the other day," and here he slipped into a husky Clint Eastwood voice, "remember, I'm Boba Fett. I'm an icon." Then I thought, wait, what am I saying? You do get silly moments. That's right. Bullock was the actor under the helmet of the jetpack-wearing bounty hunter Boba Fett in both Empire and Return of the Jedi. If there's a character that embodies more cool than the relatively smarmy Han Solo, more mystery than the backstoryless Yoda, it's Fett. The Boba Fett fan club, founded online in 1996, precedes even the founding of the 501st Legion. The legions of devotees this character commands is out of all proportion to his screen time, less than 150 seconds in the original trilogy. His fame has been gained despite, oh, who am I kidding, because of the brevity of his dialogue in the classic trilogy. Here are all the lines Fett gets to say in Empire. "As you wish. He's no good to me dead. What if he doesn't survive? He's worth a lot to me. Put Captain Solo in the cargo hold." Here's all Fett gets to say in Return of the Jedi. "Argh!" Curiously enough, that's 28 words in all, exactly the number Obi-Wan uses to describe the Force. Lesson learned. In Star Wars script world, less is more. I asked Bullock if he knew an interesting fact that had been floating around Twitter for a while, that all of his dialogue fits in a single tweet, with space for attribution. He laughed uproariously for a minute. What was even funnier, he said, was that he messed up one of those lines during filming. "Put Captain Cargo in the Solo hold," he said on set, but nobody could hear him in that helmet anyway, and his lines were dubbed over, just like Darth Vader's. Bullock was far more self-effacing than prose about his role. He'd blundered into it, a bit part that came along because his half-brother was associate producer on both Star Wars and Empire. His entire contribution to Empire took him just 2 days on set. It might interfere with the play he was then appearing in, Bullock thought at the time, but it also might be fun for his kids to see. He had no idea of Boba's origins, inside or outside of the Star Wars universe. He didn't know that George Lucas and Joe Johnston had sweated the finer points of the costume, first creating an all-white prototype and having an ILM artist run around in it at Skywalker Ranch, then putting the full-color version in a parade in Star Wars' hometown, San Anselmo, in August 1978, alongside Darth Vader, without explanation. He didn't know that Fett had been introduced in that disastrous holiday special, or that he, Bullock, was playing the most hotly anticipated new toy in the forthcoming array of Empire Strikes Back figures. You could send away box tops from boxes of Cheerios and get the action figure early. Kenner later determined that the figure's ejectable jetpack was a choking hazard. It is now one of the most valuable and sought-after toy figures in the world, which makes it quintessential Fett. Dangerous and rarely seen. No, Bullock knew none of this. What he did know was that the Boba costume happened to fit as if a Savile Row tailor had made it, he said, right down to the size 10 spiked boots. It was meant to be. Even now, Bullock is blissfully unaware of much of the culture surrounding the character. He didn't like that Boba died so stupidly in Return of the Jedi, knocked by a near-blind Solo into the great pit of Carcoon, the nesting place of the Sarlacc, the beast that gobbles him up. But as far as he was concerned, that's what happened. He's never read any of the expanded universe novels in which Fett escaped the Great Pit and went on to further adventures, including one in which he fights side by side with Han Solo. He'd never heard the MC Chris rap Boba Fett's Vet, or seen the Robot Chicken sketch that shows Boba flirting with the carbonite-covered Solo in the Slave One hold. Your hands, begging for a piece of Boba. Or the parody ad, the most interesting bounty hunter in the world. He has never had a bad feeling about this. He certainly hasn't read Fett's entry in Wookiepedia, which runs to 30,000 words, or a fifth of the length of this book. When Bullock began hitting the convention circuit, he was rather bemused by the rapturous welcomes he received. He felt he didn't deserve them. What had he done but fluffed his lines in a padded helmet and walked around a set toting a prop gun channeling Clint Eastwood, all for a little over 2 minutes? He used to try to tell fans that anyone could have been inside that helmet. But the last time Bullock sat on a panel in a room full of geeks and said that, a young boy stood up with tears in his eyes. No! Only you could play him, Mr. Bullock! Bullock doesn't deny his Boba-ness anymore. He embraced fandom, and fandom embraced back, sending him gifts such as the life-size statue of the bounty hunter that now stands at the top of his stairs. He wishes it a good night on occasion before retiring to bed. It's there to remind me, Bullock says, don't mess with Boba. First comes the jumpsuit. Gray, utilitarian, slightly shiny, like a cross between a dystopian citizen's uniform and a low-budget 1950s astronaut. It has Velcro on the shoulders, pockets on the ankles with tools sticking out the tops, deliberately scuffed orange anklets. Then the spike-tipped boots, which are a tight squeeze, as the owner of this particular costume is, like Bullock, a size 10, and I'm an 11. I'm already sweating under the convention hall lights, and I'm nowhere near the helmet yet. Next up is the armored codpiece, which I can't say is something I'd noticed Boba wearing. Like a lot of elements of Star Wars, it makes sense only in the context of the ensemble. Then there's the leather belt with a dozen brown pouches and canvas saddlebags on the side, and a cloth tunic with a three-part breastplate, with scuffs in dull silver and yellow dotted on a deep military green. No wonder there's a global organization devoted to this kind of armor, the Mandalorian Mercs. No wonder some fans have what they describe as a fetish. Me? I feel simultaneously gleeful with recognition and completely ridiculous. According to Wookiepedia, the fictional owner of this costume stands 6 feet tall. I'm afraid I'm a little short for a bounty hunter. Luckily, Michael Carrasco, the real as opposed to fictional owner of this costume, is my height. Carrasco, a real estate agent also known as TK0534, is a trooper in the Alpine garrison of the 501st. In exchange for a donation to the 501st's most vital charity of the moment, helping to buy a new set of knees for Peter Mayhew, the 7'3" actor who played Chewbacca that might walk from his wheelchair and play Chewie again in Episode 7, Carrasco has agreed to loan me his Fett costume, something the 501st doesn't normally do for outsiders. It's a work of art, a Fett costume, with 2 or 3 dozen paint colors applied to get just the right battered look, and it represents 6 months of hard labor from the owner. He affixes the jetpack. One thing about this costume, he tells me, you can't dress yourself, and hands me that iconic helmet, battered and scratched and bullet-marked in all the right places. It is not nearly as sweaty inside the helmet or as restrictive of vision as I'd imagined. The Mandalorians, the race that Boba Fett belongs to, evidently had the good sense to have visors through which you can see your feet. Troopers walk by and nod approvingly. Watch out, one says. Boba gets mobbed. Carrasco hands me my Blastech EE-3 carbine rifle, shows me how to hold it, and offers to accompany me onto the floor. We get a stormtrooper escort. I pass through the curtains into the roar of the Comic-Con crowd. It's a little overwhelming, and I walk slowly, carefully, clutching my rifle, looking from side to side to make sure I'm not about to